You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education, Collected Works, Volume 303, translated by Roland Everett. This is Lecture 8, given in Dornach on the 30th of December, 1921. Looking back over the past meetings of this conference, I feel it necessary to digress a little from our planned program in order to tell you something about the practical aspects of Waldorf education. From all you have heard so far, you will have gathered that the key to this education, both with regard to its curriculum and the methods employed, lies in the understanding of man's physical, soul, and spiritual constitution as it develops throughout the course of life. In order to follow this principle, a new look at schooling in general was necessary, with the result that, in many ways, the Waldorf school is run very differently from traditional schools. The first point we had to consider was how to make the best use of the available teaching time, especially with regard to the development of the pupil's soul life. The usual practice today is to split up the available time into many separate lessons. But this method does not allow for sufficient depth and concentration of the various subjects. Let me give you an example. Imagine that you wish to bring something to your pupils which is to be of lasting value for them, something which they can take into later life. I will choose my example from a subject which is taught in practically every school, namely from history. Imagine that you wish to introduce to your pupils the time of Queen Elizabeth I, including all the main events and personalities that are usually taught to children. This could be done by the teacher talking about the relevant facts of this historical period during the history lessons, which might take, let us say, half a year. But one can also proceed in a different manner. After a methodical preparation at home, the teacher can cultivate in himself a fine feeling for the salient facts, which then become a kind of framework for this period. These the teacher allows to work upon his soul, in this way remembering them without much difficulty. All other additional material will then fall into place, more or less naturally. If one has mastered the subject in this way, it is quite possible, and this is no exaggeration, to bring to one's pupils in only 3 to 4 lessons what otherwise might well take half a year, and this even in greater depth, so that the pupils retain a lasting impression of the subject. If you survey in detail all that children are supposed to learn at school at the present time, you will agree with the method indicated just now. For what in our present state of civilization our children are supposed to have learned already at the age of 14, is such an accumulation of material that it is simply beyond their capacity to absorb it all. No school really succeeds in imparting so much learning, but this fact is generally ignored. One merely pretends that the present system is working, and the curricula are set accordingly. The aims of Waldorf education are to arrange the entire teaching in such a way that within the shortest time, the maximum amount of content can be given to the pupils with the simplest means possible. This helps the children to retain an overall view of their subjects, not so much intellectually, but very much with regard to their feeling life. It is obvious that such a method makes great demands upon the teacher. I feel convinced that if a teacher applies this method, which I should like to call a teaching based on soul economy, he or she will have to spend at least 2 or 3 hours of concentrated preparation in order to teach for about half an hour. And this he must be willing to do if he wishes to avoid inflicting harm upon his pupils. Such preparation may not always be practically possible, but if the teacher wishes to succeed in carrying into the classroom a comprehensive and living presentation of the subject, this kind of private preparation is of fundamental importance. It certainly makes great demands upon the teacher, but such obligations are intrinsic features of his calling, which have to be accepted with the best possible response. In order to put into practice such a fundamental educational principle, it was necessary to create a suitable curriculum and timetable when the Waldorf School was founded. Today I should like to give you an outline of this curriculum and of its application, without, however, having to go into details, for this will be our task during the coming days. And so the teacher, having duly prepared himself in the way just indicated, enters the school building in the morning. The pupils arrive at school a little earlier in summertime, that is at 8 o'clock, and a little later during the winter. When they are assembled in their classrooms, the teacher brings them together by speaking a morning verse in chorus with the whole class. This verse, which could also be sung, and which embraces both a general human as well as a religious element, unites the pupils in a mood of prayer. It can be followed by a genuine prayer. In our free Waldorf school, such details are entirely left to the discretion of each individual teacher. Then begins our so-called main lesson, occupying nearly 2 hours, which in the traditional timetables are so often cut up into smaller sections. But the principle of soul economy in teaching makes it necessary to change the conventional structure of the timetable. This means that during the first 2 hours of the morning, our pupils are taught the same subject in block periods, each lasting from 4 to 6 weeks. It is left to the class teacher to introduce a short break during the main lesson, which would be essential in the younger classes. In this way, subjects like geography or arithmetic are taught for 4 to 6 weeks at a time. Thereafter, another main lesson subject is studied, again for a block period, and not in shorter lessons, to be given at regular intervals through the year. In this way, the various main lesson subjects are introduced to the pupils according to the principles agreed by us, principles which include a carefully planned economy of the child's soul life. At all costs must we avoid too much stress upon the child's mind and soul. It should never feel that lessons are too difficult. On the contrary, there should always be a longing in the child to move on from one step to the next. Never should the pupil experience an arbitrary break-off in a subject, but one thing should always lead to another. During the 4 to 6 weeks of a main lesson block period, the class teacher will always endeavor to present the content as a complete chapter, as an artistic whole, which the child can take into later life. It goes without saying that toward the end of the school year, before the approaching summer holidays, all the main lesson subjects taught during the year should be woven together into a short but artistic recapitulation. Just as we provide children with clothing wide enough to allow for their limbs to grow freely, so should we as teachers respond to their inner needs by giving them content not only suited to their present age, but also capable of further expansion. If we give the child concepts which are fixed and finished, we do not allow for this inner growth and maturing. Therefore, all concepts which we introduce, all feelings which we invoke, and all will impulses which we give must be treated with the same care and foresight with which we clothe our children's limbs. We must not expect them to remember abstract definitions for the rest of their lives. Just as, at the age of 45, our little finger will not be the same as it was when we were 8, so concepts introduced at the age of 8 should not remain unchanged when the pupils reach the age of 45. We must approach the child's organization in such a way that its various members are capable of growing and expanding. We must not, in quotes, clothe our content in such fixed and stiff forms that when a pupil reaches the age of 45, he will remember it exactly as it was given to him in his 8th or 9th year. This, however, is only possible if we present our subject matter with what I called soul economy. During the remaining hours of the morning, non-main lessons subjects are taught, and here modern foreign languages play the most important part. Foreign languages are introduced already in Class 1, when the children enter the Waldorf School in their 6th and 7th year. And they are presented in such a way that the child really can live itself into them. This means that while teaching the foreign language, the teacher will try to avoid using the child's mother tongue. The teacher of foreign languages naturally has to take into account that his pupils are older now than they were when they learned their own mother tongue, and he will arrange his lessons accordingly. This is essential if he aims to be in harmony with the pupil's particular age and development. The children should be able to live themselves into the language, such a way that they will not inwardly translate from their mother tongue into the foreign language every time they wish to say something. This continual jumping from one language into the other is to be avoided at all costs. If, for example, the teacher wants to introduce a particular word, such as table or window, he will not mention the parallel word in the mother tongue at all, but will point at the object in question while calling it out with a clear pronunciation. In this way, the child will learn the new tongue directly and well before learning to translate, if this latter activity should be considered desirable at all. We have certainly found that by avoiding, in the early stages, the usual grammar teaching with all that it entails, the children find their way into a new language quite naturally and in a living way. More details will be given later on, when we shall speak about the different ages. So far, I only wished to give you a general picture of the practical arrangements in the Waldorf School. Another subject of paramount importance at this stage is handwork, which includes several crafts. As the Waldorf School is a co-educational school, both boys and girls share these lessons, and it is indeed a heartwarming sight to see the young lads and girls sitting together, busily knitting, crocheting, and engaged in other similar activities. Experience has shown that although boys have a different relationship to knitting from girls, they do enjoy it, and they benefit from such an activity. Their working together has certainly proved advantageous to the general development of all the pupils. In other craft lessons, involving heavier physical work, girls also take part fully. In this way, the development of manual skills is nurtured and practiced in our school. A further subject taught during the morning sessions is one which could be called, quote, world outlook, close quote. You must realize that the Waldorf School or any other school which might spring from the anthroposophical movement would never wish to teach its pupils anthroposophy in the form in which it exists today. This I should consider the very worst thing one could do. For anthroposophy in its present form is a subject for grown-ups, and, as one can see by the color of their hair, often for quite mature adults. Consequently, it is presented through its literature or by word of mouth in a form appropriate only to the adult. I should consider any passing on to pupils of content taken from my title Theosophy or from my book titled Knowledge of the Higher Worlds and Its Attainment as the very worst misuse possible. Such a thing simply must not happen. For if we were to teach content which is totally unsuitable for school-agers, we should, forgive this somewhat trivial expression used in the German language, we should make the young folk want, quote, to jump out of their skin, close quote. Footnote, this German saying is often used when a person cannot bear an annoyance any longer. End of footnote. Naturally, in class lessons, they would have to submit themselves to what the teacher brought, but inwardly they, nevertheless, would experience such an urge. Anthroposophy itself is not to be taught in a Waldorf school. What matters is that its teaching should not become mere theoretical knowledge, or a world outlook based on certain ideas, but it should become a way of life, involving the entire human being. If, therefore, a teacher who is an anthroposophist enters school, he must have so worked upon himself that he has become a many-sided and skillful person, someone who has developed the art of education. And it is this latter achievement which is important, but never a wish to bring anthroposophical content to pupils. Waldorf education is meant to be pragmatic. The Waldorf school is meant to be a place where anthroposophical knowledge can find practical application. And if one has made such a world outlook, so linked to practical life, one's own, one will not turn into a theorizer who is alienated from life, but into a skilled, capable person. By this I do not mean to assert that all members of the anthroposophical movement have actually reached these aims. Far from it. I happen to know that there are still some men among our members who are not even capable of sewing on a trouser button which may have dropped off. And no one suffering from such a shortcoming should be considered a full human being. Above all, there are still members who do not fully accept the contention that one cannot be a real philosopher unless one is able to put one's hand to anything, such as mending one's shoes, should the need arise. This may sound a little exaggerated, but I hope that you know what I am trying to say. Whoever has to deal with theoretical work ought to stand in practical life even more firmly than people who happen to be tailors, cobblers, or engineers. In my opinion, any passing on of theoretical knowledge is acceptable only if the person concerned is also well-versed in all practical matters of life, for otherwise his ideas will remain alienated from life. By acting out of anthroposophical knowledge in the classroom, the teachers, as artists, should develop the ability of finding the right solutions to whatever the needs of the children may be. If teachers carry into the classroom such an attitude, together with the fruits of their endeavors, they will also be guided in particular situations by a sound pedagogical instinct. This, however, is hardly the case in the general teaching situation of today. Please do not mistake these remarks as criticism against some teachers. Those who belong to the teaching profession will be the first ones to experience the truth of what has been said. In their own limitations, they may well feel that they are the victims of prevailing conditions. The mere fact that they had to suffer the martyrdom of a high school education may be enough to prevent them from breaking through many great hindrances. What matters most during actual teaching is an ability to meet the ever-changing classroom situations, which result from the immediate response of the pupils. But who in this wide world trains teachers to do that? Are they not trained to decide beforehand what they are going to teach? This often gives me the impression that the child is not considered at all during educational deliberations. Such an attitude would be tantamount to making papier-mâché masks of each pupil as he enters school, in order to deal with these masks rather than with the actual children. As mentioned before, it is not at all our aim to teach an ideology in the Waldorf school, though such a thought might easily occur to people upon hearing that the anthroposophists have founded a new school. Our aim is to carry insights gained through knowledge of anthroposophy right into actual teaching. This is the reason why I did not mind handing over the responsibility of giving religion lessons to representatives of the various religious denominations. Religion, after all, represents the very core of a person's world outlook. And so in our Waldorf school, a Roman Catholic priest was asked to give Roman Catholic religion lessons to pupils of this denomination, and a Protestant priest was given the task of teaching the Protestant religion lessons. When this decision was taken, we were not afraid of being unable to balance any outer influence brought into the school by these priests, influence which might not be in harmony with what we were trying to do. But then a somewhat unexpected situation arose. For when our friend, Emil Molt, founded the Waldorf school, most of our pupils came from the homes of the workers employed at his factory. Among them were many children of atheistic parents, children who, had they been sent to another school, would not have received any religious instruction at all. Gradually, among these children, in the way such things happen when one is dealing with children and their parents, there arose the wish that they too should receive some form of religion lessons. And this is how our, in quotes, free, that is non-denominational, religion lessons came about. They were given by our own teachers, just as the other religion lessons were given by the respective priests. These teachers were recognized by us as religion teachers of the Waldorf curriculum. In this way, anthroposophical religion lessons were introduced in our school. These religion lessons have come to mean a great deal to many of our pupils, but particularly to the children of the factory workers. However, all this brought specific problems in its wake, for anthroposophy is there for the adult. If, therefore, the teacher wants to bring the right content into his anthroposophical religion lessons, he has to create it anew, and this is no mean task. For it means a remolding and transforming of anthroposophical content in order to make it suitable for the various age groups. In fact, this task of changing a modern philosophy to suit young people occupies us a great deal. It means working in depth on fundamental questions, such as, what is the effect upon pupils of our using certain symbols? Or, how do we deal with the imponderables inherent in such a situation? More of this later on. I am sure that you will appreciate that a school like ours, which aims at basing its curriculum upon the needs of the growing child in the light of anthroposophical knowledge of man, has to make compromises of the most varied kinds. For today it would be quite impossible to educate children according to abstract educational ideas, to be subsequently labeled as the principles of Waldorf education. The result of such a misguided approach would be that our graduates would not be able to find their way into life. It is all too easy to criticize life at the present time. Most people meet displeasing aspects of it every day. And one could easily feel tempted to make clever suggestions about how to put the world in order. But it simply won't do to educate pupils in such a way that when they leave school to enter life, they can only criticize the senselessness of all that they find there. However imperfect life may be, when judged by abstract reasoning, one nevertheless must be able to play one's full part in it. Waldorf pupils who have been treated as individuals, perhaps more than is usually the case elsewhere, have to be sent out into life. Otherwise, there would be no sense in having a Waldorf school at all. But they must not become estranged from contemporary life to the extent that they can only criticize what they meet outside. This I can only touch upon here. Right from the start, the most varied compromises had to be made, also with regard to our curriculum and our pedagogical aims. As soon as the school was founded, I sent a memorandum to the education authorities in which I made the following request. From their sixth or seventh year up to the completion of their ninth year, that is, to the end of the third class, our pupils are to be schooled according to the principles of Waldorf education without any outside interference. By this I meant that the planning of the curriculum and the standards to be achieved, as well as the methods of teaching, were to be left entirely in the hands of our teaching staff, or college of teachers, which would bear the ultimate responsibility for the running of the school. For us, it is not only important that each teacher knows the pupils of his class well, but also that a corresponding relationship exists between the entire body of teachers and all the pupils of the school, so that pupils can feel quite free to contact any teacher of their choice for guidance or advice. It is a real joy to witness, every time one enters the Waldorf school, how friendly and trusting the pupils are, not only with their class teachers, but with all the teachers, both in and out of lesson time. To return to my letter, to the education authorities, I stated that on completion of the third school year, our pupils should have reached the same standards with regard to the three R's as those achieved in other schools, so that they would be able to change schools without encountering any difficulties. This implied that a child who had had a wider educational background than the pupils of his new class, nevertheless would be able to fit into new surroundings, and that it had not lost touch with life in general. In a similar way, I stated that our teaching between the end of the pupil's ninth year and twelfth year, that is, from the end of Class 3 to the end of Class 6, again was to achieve standards comparable with those of other schools, so that our pupils would be able to enter a seventh grade in another school without falling behind. We do not wish to be fanatical, and therefore we had to make such compromises. Waldorf teachers must always be willing to cope with the practical problems of life. And if a pupil has to leave our school at the age of 14, he or she should be able to enter a high school or any other school leading up to university entrance examination. In this way, we try to put into practice what has been indicated. And now, having established our school up to the age of 14 plus, every year we are adding a new class, so that eventually we shall be able to offer the full range of secondary education leading up to higher education. This means that we have to plan our curriculum in such a way that our young people will be able to make their school leaving exams. In Austria, this exam is called maturity exam. In Germany, Abitur, which is Latin for leaving. And in other countries, there will be other names for these institutions. In any case, our pupils are to be given the possibility of entering other schools of higher education. There exists as yet no possibility of our founding a vocational school or university, for whatever we might be trying to do in this direction would always bear the stamp of a private initiative, and no government would grant us permission to issue our own certificates of education based on non-existing exam results, for we should never want to hold official examinations. Footnote: the German word used here for vocational school is Hochschule, translated literally as high school, but signifying a school for those who have finished their secondary education, but have not necessarily taken the school-leaving exam, and who wish to learn a trade or skill, ranging from manual labor to secretarial or bookkeeping skills, to crafts or household management. End of footnote. And so, the general situation forces us to make compromises in our Waldorf plan, and we are perfectly willing to acknowledge this fact. What matters to us is that, despite all compromising, the genuine Waldorf spirit lives in our teaching, and this as much as possible. As we wanted to have a complete junior year at the opening of the Waldorf school, we naturally had to take in pupils from other schools also, and this gave us ample opportunity of witnessing the fruits of the so-called strict discipline, in quotes, characteristic of other schools. We now have a little more than 2 years of, in quotes, Waldorf discipline behind us, which to a large extent consists of our trying to get rid of the ordinary kind of school discipline. I should like to give you an example of what I mean. Only a few weeks ago we laid the foundation stone for a larger school building, for up till now we had to make do with provisional classrooms only. To my mind it seemed right that all our children should take part in this stone-laying ceremony, and, as so often happens in life, things took a little longer than anticipated, so that by the time we were only just getting ready for the actual ceremony, all our pupils were already in the building. First I had to meet teachers and several other personalities, but all the children were there already. We grown-ups had to meet in our so-called staff room. What were we to do with all those children? The chairman of the College of Teachers simply said, quote, "We'll send them to their classrooms. They now have reached a stage when we can leave them unattended without untoward consequences. They won't disturb us." Close quote. So, despite the dubious discipline which had been imported from other schools, And despite our having got rid of a so-called school discipline, it had become possible to send the pupils to their classrooms without their disturbing us. Admittedly, this peace was somewhat ephemeral, so that oversensitive ears might have been offended, but that did not matter. Children who do not disturb oversensitive ears are not generally well-disciplined. Footnote, here the shorthand text is not clear. End of footnote. At any rate, the effects of imponderables in the Waldorf school became apparent to the children's good behavior under these unusual circumstances. As you know, various kinds of punishment are administered in most other schools, and we, too, had to find our ways with regard to this problem. When we discussed the question of punishment in one of our teacher meetings, one of our teachers reported the following interesting incident. He had tried to find out the effects which certain forms of punishment had upon his pupils. Among his pupils, who had experienced our kind of discipline for some time, there were a few notorious scamps. These little good-for-nothings, as such pupils are called in Germany, have produced very poor work, and they were to be punished according to usual school discipline. They were to be given detention. They were told to stay in after lessons to do their sums properly. However, when this punishment was announced in class, lo and behold, all the other pupils protested that they, too, wanted to stay in to do extra sums, for arithmetic was so much fun. So you see, the concept of punishment had undergone a complete transformation. It had changed into something desirable for the whole class. Such matters rarely happen if the teacher tries to bring them about directly, but they can become the natural consequence of the right approach. I am well aware that the problem of school discipline occupies many people's minds today. I once had the opportunity of observing closely the importance of the relationship of a teacher with his pupils, a relationship which is the natural outcome of the characterological disposition of both teacher and pupils. One could go as far as saying that whether pupils profit from their lessons or how much they gain depends on whether the teacher evokes sympathy or antipathy in his pupils. And it is absolutely open to discussion whether an easygoing teacher, who does not even work according to proper educational principles, may in effect achieve more than another teacher, who, intent on following perfectly sound but abstract principles, is unable to realize them in the classroom. There are plenty of such abstract principles to be found these days. I am not even trying to be sarcastic by calling them clever and ingenious. One could argue about their merits. But if a slovenly and indolent teacher, who nevertheless radiates warmth and affection for his children, enters the classroom, he may give more to his pupils for their later lives than a highly principled teacher whose personality calls forth antipathy. Even though the pupils of a genial but untidy teacher are not likely to grow into models of orderliness, they at least will not have to suffer from so-called nervousness in later life. Nervousness can be the result of antipathy felt toward a teacher of even excellent educational principles, who is not able to make the right kind of contact with his pupils. Such points are open to discussion, and they ought to be discussed if one takes the art of education seriously. For this reason, I once had to act in a case of this kind, and my decision may well evoke strong disapproval among some people. During one of my visits to the Waldorf school, I was told of a boy in one of the classes who was causing great difficulties. He had committed all kinds of misdemeanors, and none of the teachers of this class was able to deal with him. I asked for the boy to be sent to me, because first I wanted to find out the root of the trouble. You will admit that in many other schools such a boy would have received corporal punishment, or possibly less drastic forms of punishment. Well, I examined the boy carefully, and came to the conclusion that he should be moved up into the next class above. This change was to be his punishment. I have not heard of any complaints since. His new class teacher has confirmed that the boy has even become a model pupil, and that everything seems to be in order now. This, after all, is what really matters. The important thing is that one penetrates the very soul and nature of such a child. The cause of the trouble was that there was no human contact between him and his teacher. And since he was intelligent enough to cope with the work of the class above him, there was no parallel class in his case, the only right thing was to move him up. Had we put him down into the next lower class, we would have ruined that child. If one bears in mind the well-being and inner development of the child, one will find the right way of acting pedagogically. This is why it is good to look at specific and symptomatic cases. We have no intention of denying that in many ways the Waldorf School is built upon compromise. But as far as it is humanly possible, we shall always try to educate out of a true knowledge of man. To continue, the morning sessions are arranged in the way already indicated. Because it is essential for our pupils to be able to move on to higher forms of education, we had to include in our curriculum certain other subjects, such as Greek and Latin, which are also taught in morning lessons. In these ancient languages, soul economy is of particular importance. The afternoon lessons are given over to more physical activities, such as gym and eurythmy, and to artistic work, which plays a very special part in a Waldorf school. I will give further details in the coming days. We try, as far as this is possible, to teach the more intellectual subjects in the morning, and only when the children's head work has been done are they given movement lessons, in as far as they have not let off steam already between morning lessons. However, after these movement lessons, they are not taken back to the classroom in order to do more head work. I have already indicated that this has a destructive effect upon life. For while the child is engaged in physical movement, supersensible forces are unconsciously working through it. And the head, having surrendered itself to physical movement, is no longer in a position to resume its head work. It is therefore quite erroneous to believe that by sandwiching a gym lesson between other more intellectual lessons, one is providing a helpful change with its attendant benefits. The homogeneous character of both morning and afternoon sessions has shown itself to be beneficial to the general development of the pupils. If one constantly bears in mind the characteristic features of human nature, one will best serve human inclinations. I have already mentioned that we found it necessary to give some kind of anthroposophical religion lessons to our pupils. Soon afterward, arising out of these lessons, another need was felt, which led to the introduction of a Sunday service for our pupils. The service is in the nature of a cult in which the children take part with deeply religious feelings. We have found that such a ritual, performed before the children's eyes every Sunday morning, has greatly deepened their religious experience. The Sunday service had to be enlarged for the sake of those pupils who were about to leave our middle school. In Germany, it is the custom for pupils of this age to be confirmed in a special ceremony, which signifies their having reached a stage of maturity at which they are ready to enter life. We too have made similar arrangements for a ceremonial, which, as experience has shown, has made a lasting impression upon our pupils. In an education based upon knowledge of man, many needs become apparent which may have gone unnoticed in the more traditional forms of education. For instance, in Germany, all pupils receive school reports at the end of each school year, for it is considered essential to give them something of this kind before they go into their summer holidays. But in this case, too, we felt the need of an innovation. For I must admit that I should find it extremely difficult to accept the usual form of school reports in a Waldorf school, for the simple reason that I could never appreciate the difference between a satisfactory or near satisfactory mark, or between fair and fairly good marks, and so on. These marks are then converted into numbers, so that in Germany some reports show the various subjects arranged in one column, and on the opposite side there is a column of figures, such as 4.5, 3, 3-4, and so on. I have never been able to develop the necessary understanding for these somewhat occult relationships. and so we decided to find other ways of writing our school reports. When our pupils go into their holidays at the end of the school year, they too receive reports, but these contain a kind of mirror picture, a kind of biography of their progress during the year, written by their class teachers. And we have found again and again that our children accept these reports with inner approval. In them they can read what impression they have created during the years. They will feel that although such a description has been written with sympathetic understanding, it will not tolerate any whitewashing of less positive aspects of their work. These reports, which are received with deep inner satisfaction, end with a verse specially composed for each individual child. This verse is a kind of guiding motive for the coming years. Our kinds of reports, so I believe, have already proved themselves and will retain their value in the future, even though in some parts of Germany they have already been nicknamed as Ersatz, as report substitute. The pupil's response to life in the Waldorf school is an entirely positive one. To show how much they like their school, I should like to tell you what I recently heard from one of our mothers, for such an example helps to illustrate more general symptoms. She said, quote, "My boy was never an affectionate child. He never showed any tender feelings toward me, his mother. After his first year in the Waldorf school, while still quite a young child, his summer holidays began. When they were nearly over and I told him that soon he would be going to school again, he came and kissed me for the first time." Close quote. Such a little anecdote could be considered symptomatic of the effects of an education which is based on knowledge of man, and which is practiced in a human and friendly atmosphere. And our school reports also help to contribute toward this atmosphere. In order to introduce you to life in the Waldorf school, I felt it necessary to digress a little from our planned program. Tomorrow we shall continue with a more detailed account of the child's development after the change of teeth. I did want to include in our study a description of what by now has become the outer framework of practical life in the Waldorf school. The end of Lecture 8.